Professor Scott is a retired professor of English from Berkeley. He is an accomplished and published poet. If you look at my first email that I sent around about a week ago, you will find first a small link to his website, which will list some of the publications. I doubt they're all there. Certainly not some of those.
If you look hard enough, they're all there.
There you go. And he is a very fine researcher. He has published last year a book called The Road to 911, which I recommend at least reading a review of. I can't read all the books I'd like, but I can go on Amazon and I can get two or three decent reviews of them, of most of them, and I often do that. And so The Road to 911 might be worth a look for you. And with that, I'm going to introduce Professor Scott, who's going to talk to us about saving the American political system of a two-party organization. Dr. Scott?
Thank you very much, Peter. And I want to say that in the last chapter of my book, The Road to 9/11, and I've tried to sketch out a hope for American politics, it's grounded on the idea that the left and the right have to get together and do something about what's gone wrong at the center of this country. So I was very much in a mood. I consider myself once on the left. I don't think I'd call myself left anymore. I'm part of the growing crowd that says, let's go back to the founding fathers and see if we can't get back on track and not worry too much about left and right. However, as a member of the left, I was very flattered that perhaps the nicest print review, as opposed to web reviews — I got a lot of web reviews — but the nicest print review I got of this book, The Road to 9/11, was from a journal which on the front cover describes itself as conservative. So that gave me the hope that maybe the old left and the old right can talk to each other, and I was really thrilled when I got this invitation to come to the Republican Roundtable. This is the first for me. I've never spoken to Republicans before, and I may commit some indiscretions without knowing it, and I hope you'll just be tolerant. And because I'm a bit nervous about doing this for the first time, I intend to read my remarks. And can you hear me in the back? Good. Okay, what I want to talk about tonight is saving American politics from the present two-party system, as it has been working for years and threatens to go on working. Well, what is that system? Gore Vidal put it very memorably. He said there is now, quote, only one political party, the property party, with two right wings, Republican and Democrat. But I'm not here to despair of the American political process, but to express my qualified hopes for it. I want to argue tonight that the root problem in this country is increasing disparity of wealth and income. I'll give you some figures later on. This problem has arisen before in American history, and it has been addressed before. But in my opinion, the Paulson bailout passed last year, pushed by a Republican White House and a Democratic majority in Congress, was a scandal because it nakedly increased the disparity of wealth and income in this country. It was a raid on the wealth of the res publica, the republic, to salvage the status of its wealthiest class. This was just the last and worst example of recent government-assisted predatory corporate behavior dating back to the savings and loan scandals of the 1980s or Enron's criminal, I say criminal, gaming of California's energy deregulation at the turn of the century. A few people actually did go to jail for that, though perhaps not enough. Some of the strongest opposition to the Paulson bailout was indeed voiced by Republicans. I'm hoping that the Republican Party, and indeed both parties,
can introduce a criterion for all future bailout laws, and we are going to see more of them. The criterion is that any contemplated bailout should work to reduce disparity of income and wealth, not increase it. I think I'll say that again. The criterion is that any contemplated bailout should work to reduce disparity of income and wealth, not increase it. This is a very simple principle, and I'm hoping people in this room will endorse it, perhaps even join a movement to endorse it. In the auto industry, for example, I expect workers will have to accept cuts in remuneration, but so should management. As Kevin Phillips and others have suggested, a limit should be established by law to the maximum ratio of the highest remuneration in any industry to the lowest or average remuneration, perhaps a ratio of 20 to 1. I actually once heard that principle suggested to me by a Republican who was also a former vice president of all places, the Bank of America. So I'm hoping that at least some Republicans in this room can agree. Let me say right now that much of what I have to say is inspired by Kevin Phillips' great book, Wealth and Democracy, which came out in 2002. It's hopeful that Phillips, who began as a Republican and wrote The Emerging Republican Majority, and I, who began as a left social democrat in Canada, both agree on the need to protect the Republic from encroachments of private wealth. Both Kevin Phillips and I invoke the example of the Founding Fathers as a corrective to our present crisis, and so did President Obama in his inaugural address. That, too, is a hopeful sign. Well, what was wrong with the Paulson bailout? We clearly needed a bailout. What we did not need was a bailout altered at the very last minute by leaders of both parties, and particularly by the White House, to guarantee that the bailed out companies could go on paying huge salaries, dividends, and bonuses. And let's not forget that 85% of the dividends of the stock in this country is owned by the top 10% of the population. So when you're saving dividends, you're saving the top 10%. This change into the bailout legislation was made after the first immediate crisis had passed. Since then, we have seen Merrill Lynch's controversial decision to pay $4 billion in bonuses prematurely in December, after the firm had lost $15 billion for the quarter and $27 billion for the year. This was after officers in Citigroup and UBS, wisely, I think, had declined to accept such bonuses. Even more reprehensible is the fact that after the bailouts, Paulson and the Treasury Department refused to provide details of the Troubled Assets Relief Program, TARP, spending of hundreds of billions of dollars, while the New York Federal Reserve refused to provide information about its own bailout using government-backed loans that amounts to trillions. This lack of transparency has been challenged by Fox TV in a FOIA suit against the Treasury Department and in a suit by Bloomberg News against the Fed. Well, I never thought that I would live to applaud Fox TV. But it and I and all kinds of outsiders are uniting more and more to demand a new and more transparent direction in our crisis. And just minutes before I came here, I noticed a hopeful sign that maybe the new Obama administration may move in this direction, because just today, TARP Special Inspector General Neil Barofsky has said, this is a quote, "Oversight of the executive compensation restrictions imposed on TARP recipients is a vital component of ensuring that tax dollars are not squandered by corporate executives seeking to profit illicitly from the government's unprecedented and historic bailout of the financial industry." Well, what exactly is the crisis? In my view, it is decades, not just 1 year or 2 years, but decades of first weakening and then raiding the common treasury of this country, the res publica, for the enrichment of the rich. For three decades, this unprincipled deregulation and market fundamentalism has gone on under both parties. Now, there's something quite old here and also something quite new. What is familiar and old is the dominance of both parties by the very rich financial elements of the country. Now, here are three quotes in my book, The Road to 9/11, which I just lifted from Kevin Phillips's book, Wealth and Democracy. The first one is Thomas Jefferson in 1816 saying, "I hope we shall crush in its birth the aristocracy of our moneyed corporations, which dare already to challenge our government to a trial of strength and bid defiance to the laws of our country." The second quote is from Theodore Roosevelt in 1912. "We hold it a prime duty of the people to free our government from the control of money." So you see, this is not a new problem. The third one is a letter from Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1933, a private letter to Colonel House, and he says, quote, "The real truth is, as you and I know, that a financial element in the larger centers has owned the government ever since the days of Andrew Jackson." Well, you're hearing that from high authority, and you're hearing it over and over again. The election of 2001 recalled the election of Rutherford Hayes in 1876, which was won by one vote in a special congressional committee. Hayes went on to inaugurate the Gilded Age of robber barons and incidentally used the U.S. Army to break a railroad strike by shooting and killing 70 striking railway men. The Gilded Age ended with the reforms of the Progressive Era. I'll come back to that. Bush, in 2001, also won by one vote. In this case, it was the black vote, Clarence Thomas. His presidency became the climax of a new Gilded Age. In my book, and I spend about four or five chapters on this, I show that the new Gilded Age began in 1975 when two men in the Ford White House with the familiar names of Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney made some crucial changes using their vantage point as Chief of Staff and Deputy Chief of Staff. I'll oversimplify my four chapters into a single phrase. Rumsfeld and Cheney, faced with tough decisions after the failure of the Vietnam War, prepared for Rockefeller republicanism, a regulated economy in cooperation with trade unions, to be replaced by Reagan republicanism, a free market economy crushing trade unions. We have had a fairly sharp increase in wealth inequality dating back to 1975 or 1976. Prior to that, there was a protracted period when wealth inequality fell in this country, going back almost to 1929. So you have this fairly continuous downward trend from 1929, which of course was the peak of the stock market before it crashed, until just about the mid-1970s. Since then, things have really turned around, and the level of wealth inequality today is almost double what it was in the mid-1970s. Now, I, Peter Dale Scott, am going to interject for a moment and say, when I first came to Berkeley in the 1960s and was surrounded by Marxists, I would always say that I was not a Marxist because in America, you did not have the sharply delineated classes that Marx saw in Europe a century earlier and the class kind of class war that went with it. But I have to say that since 1980, things have changed. We don't have many Marxists anymore, but for the first time, we are beginning to see the kind of conditions where Marxist analysis might apply, and even the beginnings, and it's only that, I don't want to overstress this, but the beginnings of a possible new class war, which seems to be mostly waged from the top down, not from the bottom up. Now, here's Professor Wolf again. Up until the early 1970s, the U.S. actually had lower wealth inequality than Great Britain, and even than a country like Sweden. But things have really turned around over the last 25 or 30 years. In fact, a lot of countries have experienced lessening wealth inequality over time. The U.S. is atypical in that inequality has risen so sharply over the last 25 or 30 years. And at the end of my talk, I will say a little bit about Russia and Mexico, two other countries where we have seen the same increase in inequality. Not very inspiring examples, I may say, Russia and Mexico. Now, past excesses of American wealth, as in the Gilded Age and the 1920s, have been followed by political reforms, such as the income tax, to reduce wealth and income disparity. The Gilded Age was followed by Theodore Roosevelt and the Progressive Era. The Wall Street bubble of the 1920s, which is so much like what we've just seen in the last year or so, was followed by Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. This zig and zag of incipient plutocracy followed by reform has been a fundamental rhythm of American politics since Andrew Jackson. The question is whether we can see it happen again. As Kevin Phillips has warned, this type of reform must happen again very soon, or it may not happen at all. And this is Kevin Phillips. As the 21st century gets underway, the imbalance of wealth and democracy in the United States is unsustainable. Either democracy must be renewed with politics brought back to life, or wealth is likely to cement a new and less democratic regime, plutocracy by some other name. Now, this warning by Kevin Phillips was published in 2002, and despite all the talk of change in the last election, I do not see that any electoral challenge has yet appeared to correct this imbalance of wealth and democracy. Now, here's my message to you people. I'm hoping that there are a few good Kevin Phillips Republicans in this room to make it happen, or to help make it happen. That is my message to you tonight, and if I was smart, I might just stop there. But I want to add a little more sense of urgency to my remarks and also offer a personal prescription for what I consider to be an urgent change that is needed. Just how pathological the disparity of wealth and income has become in America is revealed in a research paper by Ian Dubecker and Robert Gordon of Northwestern University, and this is a quote now. Between 1972 and 2001, the wage and salary income of Americans at the 90th percentile of the income distribution rose only 34%, or about 1% per year. But income at the 99th percentile rose 87%. Income at the 99.9th percentile rose 181%. And income at the 99.99th percentile, this is the very top element, rose 497%. It would be foolish to think that you can have this kind of change in income disparity and wealth disparity without it having significant impact on our political system. That's the problem in a nutshell. Many of these increases are marked by the transfer rather than the creation of wealth. And they derive from what Phillips has called the financialization of America. The process, as he defines it, whereby financial services, broadly construed, take over the dominant economic, cultural, and political role in a national economy. And in his wonderful book, he shows how this happened in Spain in the 16th century and led to the rapid collapse of Spain, happened in the Netherlands in the 17th century, led to the collapse of the Netherlands, and happened very conspicuously in Britain in the 19th century, followed by the collapse of Britain as a world power. We don't want that to happen here. Now, I'm going to expand a little bit. I'm not just attacking one class in particular, but an entire culture that has encouraged the glorification of greed. As a former academic, I am upset at the role played by the best universities and business schools. Gordon Gekko's famous slogan in a movie, "Greed is good," is based on Ivan Boesky's actual words at the University of California Haas Business School, quote, "Greed is healthy," for which Boesky was cheered loudly by the listening class. This, of course, was shortly before Boesky went to jail. Then there is the problem of the mainstream media, and believe me, it is a problem. And I just want to give one example here, the case of Eliot Spitzer. I hope you all know about New York governor, as he was then, Eliot Spitzer's Washington Post op-ed just last February. Spitzer wrote that several years earlier, state attorneys general noticed a spike in predatory lending that the federal government was doing nothing about. When the states tried to rein in abusive mortgage lenders, the Bush administration finally did something. The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, OCC, issued rules nullifying all the state predatory lending laws over the objection of all 50 state banking superintendents. Think of it, even Sarah Palin's banking superintendent. And by the way, it's not in my remarks, but all 50 states' attorney general, including Alaska's, protested to Washington about this, and Washington did nothing. The clampdown, which this is still from the New York Times, the clampdown which paved the way for the subprime mortgage crisis was done by, quote, preemption, a little understood doctrine that allows the federal government to wipe away state laws. It's my understanding that the Office of Currency, of the Comptroller of the Currency, had never intervened in this way before in its history, which incidentally dates back to the Civil War and Lincoln. It was created in the midst of the Civil War. Well, Spitzer's op-ed went up on the Washington Post website on February the 13th. Remember that date. And if it had an impact, it was not the one that Spitzer had hoped for. On March the 10th, the New York Times broke the story of Spitzer's encounter with a prostitute, and then Spitzer became a front-page story. According to a later Times story, it was on the night of February 13th that federal agents staked out his hotel in Washington. Now, it's surely remarkable that the mainstream media found Spitzer's private life to be big news, but not his charges that Paulson's Treasury was prolonging the financial crisis or the relation of these charges to Spitzer's exposure. What can we learn from abroad about our present crisis? This gets a bit more personal, and I welcome disagreement, though I'm sure there will be disagreement. Both the universities and the mainstream media have celebrated the ideology of free market fundamentalism, or laissez-faire. This was the doctrine forced on Russia in the 1990s, until Russia went bankrupt. Both the average standard of living and life expectancy declined rapidly in this period. Meanwhile, the number of billionaires increased until, in 2004, Russia boasted a greater number than any other nation in the world. Then America's neighbor, Mexico, the income share of the middle class and poor has been declining ever since NAFTA was introduced. The poorest 50% received 20.7% of national income in 1984 and only 16% in 1996. The middle class also declined from about 60% of the population in the 1970s to 35% in 1995. Meanwhile, the country in 1994 with the fourth largest number of Forbes billionaires in the world was Mexico, with 24. Their declared fortunes combined would represent nearly 10% of Mexico's annual gross national product. United Nations and World Bank studies have confirmed that, outside of Africa, Mexico has the largest gap between rich and poor of all but six nations in the world. I submit we don't want to be like Mexico, and particularly if we care about democracy. Because, as Jorge Castañeda has commented, if democracy does not coincide with growth and with redistribution, in all likelihood, it will not last in Latin America. I don't want to create the mistake of thinking that in America we don't have more resources than Latin America does. But it's the direction that concerns me, and this is a direction I really think we want to turn away from as soon as we can. Now, in the case of Mexico, there is increasing agreement that the ideas of market fundamentalism, far from solving Mexico's problems, aggravated them. Amy Chua, who once worked for a U.S. bank on a Mexican privatization project, is part of this new consensus. In her book, she blamed the increase of poverty in the 1990s on this American promotion of what she called laissez-faire capitalism, a form of markets that the West abandoned long ago. She criticized the U.S. and the IMF campaign for freeing markets from government regulation as a campaign that, quote, rarely includes any significant redistributive mechanisms. Close quote. Now, in Mexico, 12 billionaires, the so-called Mexican 12, were enriched by Salinas's program, which was actually a product of the so-called Washington Consensus, in other words, came from Washington, of directed deregulation or selective liberalization. This lack of controls over capital movements, another feature of the liberalization pushed by the Washington Consensus, was a major factor in the impoverishment of the majority. In the case of Mexico, there was massive withdrawal of foreign and domestic capital in December 1994, leading to an estimated $70 billion loss in the stock market value of Mexican corporations, an avalanche of bankruptcies, and nearly a million layoffs over the next 12 months. Do you recognize that that's exactly what we're seeing happen here now? And one of the underreported aspects of it is the withdrawal of foreign capital. The case I know most about is Saudi Arabia, but I'm sure it's not the only country. Why would they want to stay in a sinking stock market? So they just leave and we pay the price. And not only we, but little countries like Iceland that had nothing to do with this crisis are thrown into abject poverty, unemployment, political crisis. The government has just collapsed there, not because of anything they did wrong, but because what was done wrong here. Now, as a former diplomat with experience at the UN, I personally believe that in due time, we will see that movements of international capital need to be regulated internationally, even if this prevents American billionaires like George Soros from enriching themselves by speculating against other nations' currencies. And by the way, George Soros agrees with me about this. He feels somewhat guilty about the fact that he made $1 billion by speculating against the pound. But I have not come here as an academic to promote my own economic theories. Rather, I am hoping to encourage a movement that aimed at reducing income wealth and disparity in this country by applying this criterion to future bailout legislation. And as I said before, I'm hoping that there are a few good Kevin Phillips Republicans in this room to help make this happen. Thank you very much.
Please do sponsor our sponsors, Radio Chomsky. To donate, just go to www.radiochomsky.org.